Claiming the title, Governor Terry Branstad, now the longest-serving governor of any state ever. Insights from journalists, professional colleagues, and an academic researcher on this edition of Iowa Press.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation.
I'm a dad.
I am a mom.
I'm a kid.
I'm a kid at heart.
I'm a banker.
I'm an Iowa banker.
No matter who you are, there is an Iowa banker who is ready to help you get where you want to go. Iowa Bankers, allowing you to discover the genuine difference of Iowa banks.
Iowa Communications Network. The availability of high-speed broadband service is essential to fulfilling the promise of a connected Iowa. ICN's Broadband Matters campaign showcases the importance of delivering broadband to all corners of Iowa. Information is available at broadbandmatters.com. Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to the causes and communities they care about, for good, for Iowa, forever. Details at iowacommunityfoundations.org. The Associated General Contractors of Iowa, the public's partner in building Iowa's highway, bridge, and municipal utility infrastructure.
The Arlene McKeever Endowment Fund at the Iowa Public Television Foundation, a fund established to support local programming on Iowa Public Television.
For decades, Iowa Press has brought you politicians and newsmakers from across Iowa and beyond. Now celebrating more than 40 years of broadcast excellence on statewide Iowa Public Television. This is the Friday, December 25 edition of Iowa Press. Here is Dean Borg.
With every tick of the clock, Terry Branstad is making history. With one of those clock ticks last week, he passed the 21-year record of George Clinton in governing New York during split tenures more than 200 years ago. Political colleagues and other friends, both Democrats and Republicans, celebrated the milestone with the governor at the Iowa State Fairgrounds. And today, we're convening a group for some insight on this North Iowa farm boy turned politician, and now with a unique place in history. UNI political scientist Chris Larimer researches and writes about Iowa's governors. Iowa Department of Management Director Dave Roederer is Branstad's former chief of staff. And Tim Albrecht formerly directed the governor's communication and media relations with journalists such as Des Moines Register columnist Kathy Obradovich and Radio Iowa's news director Kay Henderson.
Tim, when did you first meet Terry Branstad, and what was your impression of him?
Well, I'm actually friends with his son, so the meeting probably would have occurred then, but I doubt he would remember that. So I really got to know him when I began working on his campaign exactly 1 year from Election Day on November 2nd, 2009.
Dave, when did you first meet Terry Branstad, and what was your impression?
I met him when he was in the state legislature, and I had just graduated or was in college during that period of time. And I thought, man, this guy's full of energy. He as a legislator, he was nonstop, whatever issue he had. I wouldn't say we were good friends at that time, but I thought this guy is really, he's got more energy than I've seen any legislator.
So in this century and in last century, Chris, you've written a book about Terry Branstad and governors of Iowa in general. What would you say is Iowan's first or lasting impression of this governor?
I think that he's accessible, that people can reach out to the governor's office and get a meeting with the governor, even though he's now, you know, nationally recognized for setting this record. He's still accessible. I think that's a big part of his legacy.
And Dave, since you've known Terry Branstad the longest, how do you think he has changed over the years?
You know, I was thinking about that when we got to the longest serving. Energy wise, no change. I mean, he is as passionate about this state today as he was when I first met him as a state legislator. I think through the years of experience, you become more wise. He has the ability to dissect issues probably quicker and better than when you're first starting. He's able to put it in context, and he knows the state so much better as well. I mean, when you travel the state, you visit every county every year. You can't pull up a county or a town that he hasn't been to and he doesn't understand the people there.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've known him long enough, Tim, to have noticed a change over the time. But I'll ask you that in case there is something. And secondly, just what do you think that you've learned from him? What was the most important thing?
Well, it was an honor to work for him because as a kid growing up, I would see him on my television every day up in Northwest Iowa. So he was an iconic figure already when I got to work for him, and it was a real honor. But one thing that I've learned about him is that he never forgets anything. He doesn't forget people. He doesn't forget what happens. However, his political memory is actually short. If you look at Senate Democrats, for instance, they've really politicized the institution and are taking their cues from Washington, D.C., but they will be the first people to be right next to him when there's a ribbon cutting in their district or to get a pen when legislation is signed. And that's a testament to Terry Branstad. He doesn't hold it against him, and he's fond of saying, you know, an adversary one day could be your greatest ally the next.
Well, at his celebration this week, just recently, Congressman Leonard Boswell was one of the people who spoke, someone who served opposite Terry Branstad in the legislature and now is working with him on a veterans home base, Iowa.
It was a big priority to have this be a bipartisan event. So not only did Congressman Boswell speak, but Congressman Neil Smith and Congressman Greg Ganske were in attendance, and as you know, Ganske had defeated Smith in 94. So that's the kind of guy that Terry Branstad is. He can bring people with differing opinions together.
How many legislators were there?
There were a number.
Democratic legislators?
I know that Attorney General Miller and Treasurer Fitzgerald were there.
Chris, the big parlor game in Iowa right now is, will Terry Branstad serve out this term?
Yeah.
Will he turn the reins over to Kim Reynolds, or will he even seek re-election to an even more unprecedented seventh term? Right. As someone who's studied governors, do you have a sense?
I don't. I think I'd actually ask Tim or Dave what they think on that. I would say this, that a big part of Branstad's legacy is, as I said, his accessibility. I think that plays well with Iowans, and they expect that out of their governor at this point. I think he's changed the perception of the governor's office. Another part of that, it deals with the strength of the challenger. And if you have a strong challenger, that can deter other people from running for office. And I think that was a big part of his comeback in 2010.
What do you think his strength is in intimidating others?
I think the Branstad name intimidates others at this point, and I think it could potentially deter a strong challenger. So if he would want to run, I think he would be in good position to win again if he chose to do that.
Does it also, though, intimidate others within the party? And I ask you that, first of all, you, and then Chris, and then you, Dave.
To some extent it does, because in the sense that if they don't see a reason for change, then I don't think they would want to put their name forward. I mean, the last thing you want to do as a political candidate is your first time out get clobbered. And so I think it potentially does deter some from within the party, but not the way it would deter someone from the other party. I think it's a more friendly deterrence, I guess.
To Kay's question, the two-part question, one, will he serve out the term, and will he serve a run for another term? Emphatically, no question, no doubt. I don't even have an ounce of me that says he will not fill out his term. He will complete this term. No question about that. Now, whether or not he runs next term, I don't think he's even thought about that. And that's way, way too early with three years left. But to Chris's point, the stronger the candidate on the opposite side even strengthens Terry Branstad. I mean, that really gets his political campaign juices going, is that the stronger a candidate, the more he likes it. So that will never be a factor in his mind as to whether or not to run again.
In 2010, he was almost competing against himself in the sense of, Jack Hatch wasn't that much of a challenge, and so he set up other challenges, like trying to win Lee County that he had never won before. I mean, Tim, is that essential part of his character, do you think, that he's setting up these competitions even if he doesn't have strong competition?
Yeah, he's a really competitive guy, and whether it's via the election or or via against other states, you know, and governors in other states. He wants to be the top job creator. He wants to be the nation's leader in education. He wants to have the best managed state. And every day, that's what drives him. So, yes, even in years with token opposition like 2014, he still sets those competitions for himself.
But I think, as Tim pointed out, with the governor, campaigns are a means to a bigger goal. Now, over the years, it seems like campaigns have become the goal is the total goal is to win. That's not the case. The reason you run for office to get elected is so you can do something once that you get in. So the campaign itself in winning is the means. It's what you do when you get there. And I think that's kind of gotten reversed.
It's a good point, though, because over the years, what I've heard about Terry Branstad is that he campaigns a little bit differently than he governs, that he tends to run more conservatively, and he governs more in the middle. Do you think that's true, Dave?
Well, the fact of the matter is, Iowa is a pretty much a middle state. I mean, one of the things that attracts, I think, and it helps us keep our caucuses is the fact that we're not either a blue state or a red state. I mean, we're pretty much a purple type of state. And so when you have somebody like the governor who travels throughout the state, he doesn't travel out throughout the state just because he wants to go to a particular community. He goes out there because he wants to know what those folks are thinking. And so that's when he's making decisions, putting programs together, he thinks, okay, well, wait a minute, how's this going to be in Fremont County? How's this going to be in a large county like Polk County or Linn County or Johnson County?
Tim, let me ask you, piggybacking on what Dave just said, Iowa Republicans have pretty much gone to the right, and some of the more moderate, or you might even say liberal, if you can put that in the Republican Party, people have been ostracized. How has Terry Branstad been able to bridge that gap?
Well, Terry Branstad cares about this state, and even his fiercest opponents will have to concede that he loves Iowa, and that shows through. So when it comes to politics, the way you're describing, he's able to bridge that because he gets things done and he works hard on behalf of all Iowans, and that includes the conservative and the moderate wings of our party, as well as independents and Democrats. He bridges everybody in Iowa, and that's really his legacy.
Okay.
Chris, I want to go back to the campaigner in chief, Terry Branstad. Yeah. 82, 86, 90, 94, 2010, 2014. If you ask Democrats, they see in Branstad an ability to attack an opponent on their strength.
Yeah.
Did you find that in your reporting?
Yes, I did. Part of it was doing interviews with various individuals throughout the state, and that was a big part of it, that Terry Branstad defines his opponents before they can define themselves, was one of the quotes from one of the sources in the book. And I think that's certainly the case. I mean, he's a very political figure, and he understands state politics very well, and I think that's part of it. To Tim and Dave's point earlier, though, about governing with within different factions of the party, part of the story is also that Governor Branstad has dealt with a divided or split legislature for most of his time in office, and and actually within political science research, that's actually to the benefit of the governor, because voters don't have any one particular individual toward which to direct blame. If there's unified control, as there was with Governor Culver, if something goes wrong, voters can look to the chief executive and direct their blame that way. But if you have a split legislature, that actually works to the benefit of the chief executive. So for Governor Branstad, he's had that for the last 5 years. He had that for 10 or 12 of those first 16 years in office. And so, governing in that type of atmosphere, I think, actually works to his advantage in a purple state, as Dave said.
Go ahead, Kathy.
I was going to say, whoever wants to tackle this first, Tim, but don't you think that one of his big priorities will be to actually get a full Republican-controlled legislature for his the last part of his term?
Of course, and that's what Terry Branstad does, is he wants to help elect Republicans up and down the ticket, not even just in the legislature, but congressional, Senate. So he's a team player, and that's another reason he's been able to bridge the divide within our party.
Dave, what's the most difficult decision you ever saw him make?
You know, Dean, fair question. I would say the toughest series of decisions he had to make, it wasn't just one particular decision, but it was during the farm crisis, when our state was really...
What decision was that?
It was debt refinancing and the fact that a person who he loved dearly in Ronald Reagan, in his administration, were not responding to the way of which he wanted to do that.
So what did Terry Branstad do?
What Terry Branstad is, I'd like to say it in a nice way, he took on the administration and he went out to Washington. And he demanded that they pay attention. And he and some of the president's closest advisors had more than just heated discussions about it. And the governor was pointing out that what the federal government was doing was so wrong because that it was costing the federal government more.
But was it successful? Did he win?
It was successful. It took longer than it should have. And that's not unusual from the federal government to see them kind of get it about a year or two late. Mm-hmm. And it helped. It could have saved a lot more farmers, and it could have saved our state a lot of angst and pain had they acted a year before they did. But eventually it got done, and obviously we're rebounded.
Let's explore the legacy a little bit in terms of the party. Dave, you were involved in McCain 08.
Yes.
Which was sort of a down cycle for the Republican Party of Iowa.
That was a nice way of putting it.
trying to be kind.
Yes, sir.
Anyway, how has his return in office changed the GOP, and yeah. How would you assess his long-term influence in the party?
You know, very quickly, putting it into context, Terry Branstad, Charles Grassley, they were outsiders of the party. They were not part of the quote-unquote party operation. And they ran from the outside and came in. When Terry Branstad got elected governor, he found out that he was the party, okay? Once you become governor, you're the rallying point. And he's taken that job very, very seriously. And he has worked, as Tim had pointed out earlier, and Krista too, that he has worked to try to bring all factions of the party together. And that he has been, listen, he can meet with the most moderate Republican and 1 hour, and the next hour he may be meeting with the Tea Party folks, just to try to show them where we agree on issues, and tries to grow that the agreement instead of concentrating on where the divides are.
Chris, would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I would. Part of the research I did was to included a couple of interviews with Governor Branstad. And, you know, to the broader point about his governing style, he admits that governing with a split legislature is actually beneficial. So I think, you know, he's obviously going to recruit members of the Republican Party to try to get majority in the Iowa House, in the Iowa Senate, as Tim said. But governing with a split legislature, I think at this point, doesn't scare Governor Branstad in any way. As he said, it's actually to his benefit. And I also spoke to Governor Vilsack on this point, he made the same argument, that governing with a split legislature or divided government is actually to their benefit.
And Chris, you did some research on where the governor's power comes from. And, of course, part of Terry Branstad's power comes from his longevity.
Yeah.
But statutorily, it's not really, you know, the strongest governor's office in the country by any means. So are there other ways that you think Terry Branstad has actually grown the power of the authority of the governor's office?
I would say it's in the expectations that Iowa voters have for the governor's office. I think, you know, at this point, you know, the 99-county tour, the full Grassley as Jason Noble called it from the Register, is certainly expected. And in the interviews that I did throughout the state, you know, the three top factors were that the governor has to establish a personal connection, he or she has to work hard, and they have to do the full Grassley or the 99-county tour. Governor Branstad, Governor Vilsack, and Governor Ray, you can kind of group all three of them together as governors who did all three of those things. They were accessible, they did the 99-county tour, they created a sense of sort of what I call Iowa comfort among Iowa voters. And so I think that's expected at this point. And, you know, there's a feedback with presidential candidates as well. They're, you know, Iowa voters are at this point feeling, if I can see a presidential candidate up close, I better be able to see my governor up close. And so I think that's changed the expectations.
And Dave, the governor has also tested the boundaries of his authority in the budget, for example.
Sure.
His item veto, he's been in court a number of times over the item veto. Sometimes he wins, sometimes he loses. Is that an intentional thing where he's testing these boundaries, or is it just in the course of business that this happens?
Kathy, one of the things to remember, the power for a governor comes from people. It's the people out there. I mean, that's one of the reasons that he's constantly out amongst people is because that Once you have, when you have the folks with you in our democracy, you do well. If you don't have the people with you, you're usually referred to as former something or other. As far as the, I'm sorry, I got off on your question. What
no,
was
no, no, about the constitutional authority
constitutional
of the governor
authority.
and having that being tested in court.
And one of the reasons is because language isn't always as clear as one might think. And issues come up, different things approach. So, no, it's never a matter of sitting there saying, okay, let's test the Constitution today. No, it's a set of circumstances that come forward, and then you say, okay, do we have the authority to do we not have authority to do that? And on those type of issues, especially on item vetoes, because our item veto language by the Iowa Supreme Court has kind of changed a little bit as time goes on. There hasn't really been all that much case history on it. So it's the governor tries to weigh both sides, and if he thinks that it's not within his power to do it, he doesn't do it.
And Tim, the Democrats right now are really hot under the collar about some of the executive actions that the governor has taken, including closing the mental health institutes, including going forward with closing workforce development offices, for example, even though the courts disagreed with
education
that item veto. The education veto. So, you know, what do you say to folks who are saying, okay, the governor has been there too long, he's actually abusing the authority that he has?
The governor always likes to say people love progress, but they hate change. And I think a lot of times that's what this comes down to. And like Dave said, you know, language can be imprecise sometimes. And the governor speaks the language of economic development very well. And people understand that he's a job-creating governor, and he's going to look out for this state's best interests. And he'll always do so based on what he believes is his constitutional authority. And sometimes, yes, that's going to get challenged because
people
don't like
change. But Tim, he's presided also over a couple of decades of erosion in the rural sector. That is, you said, as job creator, but rural Iowa has declined during those two administrations.
Well, I think that's a national issue, and he is acutely aware, coming from rural Iowa. And a lot of times, these businesses, these factories, actually do want to expand in rural Iowa, but there just aren't the people to fill the jobs. And he's tried to address that through Skilled Iowa, through the Home Base Iowa initiative, inviting veterans from across the country. So he does readily identify with that problem. Just this last session, Connect Every Acre, putting high-speed broadband access out there to rural Iowa. So he's aware of this, and he's working hard on that every day.
Chris, before we leave legacy, has he changed the image and the role of the lieutenant governor? That is, he's got Kim Reynolds now out with him all the time. I didn't used to see that in past administrations. Has he changed it, conceding that it may be an ulterior motive?
Well, I think it's a good question. I actually haven't thought of it that way. But I think, you know, it may just be simply the case, the recognition on the part of Governor Branstad and Lieutenant Governor Reynolds, that if she would want to run for the top position, she's going to have to be familiar with every part of Iowa. And so I think it may just be that the expectations of the governor's office are starting to spill over into the lieutenant governor's office.
What do you think, Dave?
The fact of the matter is that the governor made it very clear that when he selected Kim Reynolds, now Lieutenant Governor Reynolds, that they were going to be a team and they were going to work together. And they get along very, very well. And they do not travel together all the time. Lieutenant Governor has her schedule, he has his, but yeah, I would say they're as in sync as you could have two individuals be in sync.
You were involved in the previous 16-year run. What changed? That dynamic didn't appear to be evident when Joy Corning was his running mate and co-governor.
Joy Corning did a tremendous job. And that was the first time a governor and lieutenant governor ran as a team. Mm-hmm. And so I think there was a little bit of a trial and error period during that period of time. Times were a little bit different then, so issues were a little bit different. Lieutenant Governor Corning brought great strengths, as does Kim Reynolds. I think that Joy Corning had really at first didn't think that she, you know, would want to be, you know, run for governor on her own. So those dynamics were a little bit different as well.
Chris, let's talk about the national influence of this longest serving governor in the universe. I'm thinking back to his previous run in the first four terms. He influenced welfare reform at the state level, But when there's a discussion about welfare reform at the national level, everybody points to Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin mm-hmm. as the germinator of that idea. Why has Terry Branstad's influence nationally not been as great as one might suspect from someone who's served so long in office?
Well, I think part of it is just the way that politics is covered. I think, you know, certainly national politics, you know, the conversation is about how polarized it is. I don't think among folks who follow state politics, you know, I think Governor Branstad is certainly recognized. Part of it is, you know, there's a lot of policy experimentation going on in the states. And so I think governors are still a key part of that. I think Governor Branstad may not necessarily have the signature policy like a Tommy Thompson on welfare reform. But I think in terms of governing style, relationships with voters, fundamentally changing the expectations that voters have and how constituents relate to a governor's office, I think he has had a significant impact. So I imagine, you know, when they have the National Governors Association meeting here in Des Moines next summer, I would think that some of his colleagues are going to be talking to him just, you know, maybe not necessarily about particular policies, but about constituent relationships.
We've been talking about the governor's legacy, Dave, but he likes to say he's not finished yet, right? So is there something to come that that people will look to, do you think, as the governor's legacy or his legacy legislation for the end of his last term?
The end of this term. You know, I don't know. I feel a little uncomfortable talking about legacies because I don't think legacies really come into effect till after somebody's been gone.
What she's really asking is, in the condition of the state, is he going to unveil something?
What's the next big thing?
Yeah, like I'm going to tell you what the state of the state's going to be. No, seriously. I would say stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Well, what about you, Tim? What do you think will be coming that will put a cap on Terry Branstad's time?
To the earlier point, I think that he's not one who wants to grab national headlines. He's not going to be flashy in the policy arena. But what was interesting to me at the longest-serving event at the fairgrounds this month was the chair of the National Governors Association, Governor Herbert, said, when we gather for our meetings and Terry Branstad talks, we all listen. So I do think he does have an influence on his colleagues, and he has that quiet influence that maybe we don't see every day but is felt throughout this country.
Well, we're going to have to draw this to a close. Thank you for your insights. It's been interesting.
Thank you.
And we'll be back next week with another edition of Iowa Press, a half hour earlier next week at 7 o'clock New Year's Day, noon as usual on Sunday. I'm Dean Borg. Thanks for joining us today, and happy holidays. Merry Christmas to you.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation.
I'm a veteran.
I'm a builder.
I'm a volunteer.
I am a teacher.
I'm a banker.
I'm an Iowa banker.
No matter who you are, there is an Iowa banker who is ready to help you get where you want to go. Iowa Bankers, allowing you to discover the genuine difference of Iowa banks.
Iowa Communications Network. ICN's Broadband Matters campaign advocates for access to high-speed broadband in all corners of Iowa, for education, public safety, health care, government, and economic development. Information is available at broadbandmatters.com.
Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to the causes and communities they care about, for good, for Iowa, forever. Details at iowacommunityfoundations.org. The Associated General Contractors of Iowa, the public's partner in building Iowa's highway, bridge, and municipal utility infrastructure.
The Arlene McKeever Endowment Fund at the Iowa Public Television Foundation, a fund established to support local programming on Iowa Public Television.